provides a very good description. So these models typically have some sort of screening mechanism that dynamically suppresses the modifications as you approach smaller scales or higher density regions to screen away the modifications to gravity and to recover, or at least for these models to be sufficiently close to general relativity. Later on, I'm going to give an example of how this can work. So in this slide I'm showing, just to bring everyone to the same page, just to give you a picture of how model building of dark energy works. This is not by any means representative. I'm showing here a couple of cosmological models, and they all have some things in common. They all have the Einstein-Hilbert turn, so Einstein gravity. They all have LM. So LM here is just the standard model of particle physics plus some Lagrangian for the dark matter particle. And then in red, I'm showing stuff that you add to accelerate. So in this model, this is the Einstein de Sitter model, so there's no acceleration. This is ruled out. This is lambda CVM, quintessence, K essence, F of R, scalar tensor theory. You can also think of ways of coupling the scalar field to matter. But the picture I want to take is that this is really phenomenological. You just keep GR, you have matter, and then you come up with your more or less motivated model that's going to cause the acceleration. So going now to the Galilean gravity model. So the story of the Galilean goes around the so-called Galilean shift transformation, which is this shift here of partial derivatives of a scalar field, which is known as the Galilean. And this all started in 2009, where Nicolas et al. Found that in four-dimensional Minkowski space, you can only write five Lagrangian densities that, one, are invariant under this transformation, and two, the equations of motion are kept up to second order in field derivatives in the derivatives of the metric and of the scalar field. And this is crucial to avoid the propagation of Ostrogradsky ghosts. So indeed, this Lagrangian satisfies those two desirable properties. We can suppress the modifications in the solar system by means of a mechanism known as the Weinstein screening effect. And so I'll explain how this works later on again. And indeed, after covariantization, which was done by Defayet et al. In the same year, you can find that the model can reproduce a healthy radiation, matter, and accelerated and present-day accelerated air. So this is the action of the model. So we have here GR. We have matter, we have the Galilean bit in the middle, which is the sum of the five Lagrangian densities, here they are, each multiplied by a constant. So sometimes people get confused about this, so I want to make this clear. In this model, the scalar field does not couple directly to matter. So if you are in space, if you are in flat space-time, if you have Lagrangians such as this, you need to include an explicit coupling of the scalar field to matter if you want to have interesting phenomenology. And by interesting phenomenology, here I mean you want the equation of motion of the Galilean field to be sourced by something other than zero. In a cosmological setup, so when I go from flat space-time to FRW, when I promote these partial derivatives to covariant ones, in particular here, in this term here, there are this nonlinear derivative coupling. So because now these covariant derivatives contain partial derivatives of the metric, you're going to sort of mix partial derivatives of the scalar field with partial derivatives of the metric. And this is why this model is called the modified gravity model. This is a mechanism known as kinetic gravity braiding. And that without a coupling, I now have something interesting, so the energy momentum, the Ricci tensor sourcing the Galilean field equation of motion. So going back to the Lagrangian, to the action. So we have a lot of Lagrangians here, so it's useful to try to organize this. The first thing I'm going to do is to ignore L1 until forever. Basically, this is the only place in the theory where the field, instead of derivatives of the field, appear. And I'm only going to be interested in the cases where kinetic energy terms drive the acceleration as opposed to potential ones. Then in the remaining of this, I'm going to be saying the words cubic Galilean, quartic Galilean, and quintic Galilean quite often. So when I say cubic, I mean the model that is made up by L2 and L3. So I go to the action, and I fix C4 and C5 to be zero. The quartic model is the model that adds up L4 to this. And finally, the quintic is the most general one that encompasses all of the Lagrangians. In the case of L4 and L5, in addition to the kinetic braiding that exists in the coupling of derivatives, there are also explicit couplings to gravity to the Ricci scalar here and to the Einstein tensor in L5. These are needed to keep the theory, to keep the equations of motion of the theory up to second order when you go from flat space-time to an FRW. And as I'll show later on, these couplings here are going to have very important consequences in what concerns the observational viability of these models. Yeah?
So is there a reason to use just this Galilean rather than this general scalar tensor theory of second order equation?
Not really. So basically, Galilean is a subset of Horndeschi theory that is Galilean invariant. I think, like, historically, okay, besides Horndeschi, we invented the model. The rediscovery of Horndeschi came up, like, was inspired by the Galilean.
But it's not Galilean invariant.
Yes, it's not, yes. It's only Galilean invariant in the limit of flat spacetime. Absolutely, yeah. These couplings here break the Galilean symmetry. So this is the parameter space that I'm aiming to constrain. So it is made up of the same seven cosmological parameters as lambda CDM. So just for completeness, this is the baryon density, Kullback matter density, the value of the H naught today, the expansion rate today. NS and AS specify the spectral index and the amplitude of the primordial power spectrum, optical depth of ionization, and then the sudden mass of the neutrinos, which I take here to be a free parameter. And then the Galilean subspace of parameters, which can be five-dimensional. So the four Galilean parameters plus initial values for the Galilean field. And then I'm going to do next to try to convince you why I can reduce the dimensionality of this part of the parameter space from 5 to 2.
Can I just ask, I'm curious about your question. So there is no Galilean invariant theory where you couple to Galilean invariant theory, where you couple to gravity, or it hasn't been found yet, or what's the status?
There is no Galilean.
So this comment that Kurt made, that the Galilean invariant theory, when you couple it, once you put it on a non-flat background, is not, once you include those terms, is not Galilean invariant. Is there any known coupling to gravity that is Galilean invariant, or no? I guess not.
I guess not. Yes. I guess
there is, if you couple it to a mass of gravity.
Oh yeah.
And is this we haven't found it yet, or we know there is no such thing?
For normal gravity, there is no such thing. Okay. Or maybe we haven't found that. Okay. There's no known such thing.
You're saying velocity zero mode basically is the...
Even apart from that. So you can couple a Galilean to a massive graviton in such a way that it's a new field in addition to the velocity zero mode that also has Galilean invariants.
Can I ask a question about philosophy? So you said you're very observational, so you're going to ask the data to inform what is the underlying theory. So you're picking a particular theory, which is this one, and some of us would argue very strongly that it doesn't have a well-defined initial value of problem. So why bother? Why bother just biasing your search with respect to one particular theory, which in its own has its own problems? Why not just ask the data, parameterize your ignorance, and see where the data takes you?
Okay, that's a very, very, very good question. It takes a really long time to answer. I completely agree with you that in the future, going on a model-by-model basis is really not the thing to do. Because, I mean, you're going to spend a lot more time focusing on individual models, and, I mean, you have an infinite number of models, so this is completely unfeasible. How can I justify this? So this is a model that, as I will hopefully show you, this is a model that contains a very rich phenomenology. So although I'm focusing on one model, I think I'm going to learn a lot of things of how modifications to gravity can impact observables. So although, okay, this model here has its own problems, but maybe in the future we're going to come up with a model that shares some things in similar, and by then we already know how to best tackle the situation. So in some sense, to focus on a model like this, I'm asking the data to tell me what can we learn from, by studying models today, we learn more about what future models can impact the observations. So I'm going to reduce the dimensionality of this part of the parameter space. The first thing I'm going to use of is there is this scaling degeneracy in the Galilean equation. So I'm here in illustrating with the background density of the Galilean field, but this actually holds for any equation of the model. And the physics do not change if you make this transformation here, where B is a constant. So basically, this means that you cannot simply add all of those Lagrangian in the action, multiply them by a constant. You're going to get, so if I'm going to vary all of these parameters, I'm going to get an infinite degeneracy. So in some sense, one of these parameters here is not a physical degree of freedom. And the easiest way to break this degeneracy is to fix one of the parameters. I choose to fix C2 equals to minus 1, but this is not critical. I could have fixed any other parameters.
And just to check, using pi dot, you really mean pi dot, you're assuming a homogeneous.
Here I mean I mean both the background and the perturbation. But the perturbations I always fix them to start at zero. So that.
So I'm just asking: is that dot really only a derivative with respect to time, or is it really all secretly all the derivatives?
No, just the time.
Okay.
just time. Okay, and then, okay, C2 is gone. The two other parameters, I'm going to fix them by noting that several initial conditions for the background evolution are attracted to a solution, which I call here the tracker solution, that is characterized by this. So here I have, for instance, the colored lines are for the Galilean in different initial conditions, eventually merge the blue one, which is the one characterized by the tracker. So for simplicity, I can assume that the tracker is going to be followed at all times. So if I take, if I plug this condition into the condition to make the universe spatially flat and into the equation of motion of the Galilean field, now I have two constraint equations that are going to allow me to fix two more parameters. And then I arrive at the final shape of the parameter space that I'm going to constrain, which is the 7 cosmological plus 2 dimensional Galilean parameter space. So step by step, this is what we're going to do. So first, we're going to derive the fully linearly perturbed equations. This can be quite a lengthy task, I mean, given the complicated shape of all those Lagrangians. The important thing here is that it's going to be a linear study. So the screening mechanism, which relies on the presence of nonlinear terms, is not going to play a role, at least for now. Then we modify the chem code to follow the cosmology of the Galilean model. So to get predictions for the CMB power spectrum, linear meta power spectrum, etc. And then we're going to search over the parameter space. We installed CAMP into Cosmo MC. And we're going to search all over the parameter space. And the likelihood of each point is determined by this data set. So I'm going to use the temperature data from Planck. Yeah?
We must be using Wmap polarization to fix tau as well. Or putting fire on tau.
I am using, so when I'm in here Planck TT, I mean Planck high L, Planck low L, and the low L cross-correlated with the Wmap polarization. So there are three components when I say here Planck TT. Absolutely. So I'm using these three components of the Planck temperature data. I'm using also the lensing power spectrum data from Planck, and then a couple of BAO data points from a number of galaxy surveys. So this slide here contains one of the main results of this talk. So I'm showing here the confidence contours. These are two sigma contours for lambda CDM with massive neutrinos in green, Galilean model with massive neutrinos in red, and Galilean model without massive neutrinos in blue. So the dashed contours are the constraints obtained using only the Planck and lensing, so only the CMB. And the blue contours add the BAO to it. And I'm showing here the total metadensity versus H0, sigma 8, which is the amplitude of the metapower spectrum on large scales versus the sun masses of the neutrinos. There are many things I can discuss here. I want to focus only on three main aspects. The first one has to do with the constraints on the sun masses of the neutrinos. Whereas in the case of the Galilean model, there is over six sigma evidence for neutrinos to be massive, in clear contrast with what happens in lambda CDM, where this is compatible with zero. And this strong evidence for the existence of massive neutrinos is driven by a tension in the value of H0 when you don't have massive neutrinos. So if you focus here on the blue contours, if I use only the CMB, the dashed contours prefer high values of H0. When I add the BAO, the value of H0 has to be much smaller, so the two contours do not overlap, and I have here an observational tension. However, when I allow the mass of neutrinos to vary, sigma m nu is degenerate with H, and the Galilean model no longer, the CMB data in a Galilean cosmology no longer prefers high values of H0, and it does so in such a way that when I add the BAO data, the two contours now overlap, and there is no tension. And I think this is quite interesting because future experiments like Catherine, done here on Earth, will soon, I mean 5 to 10 years, be able to probe the absolute mass scale of the sum of the neutrino, of the sun mass of the neutrinos down to scales of 0.2 to 0.4. So this provides an interesting window for like Earth-based experiments to have a say in cosmological constraints. And this goes back to the question you asked me. So now I know that if I have a model with an expansion history that is closer to the lambda, to the Galilean model, I know that it's probably going to be some evidence for this model to prefer high values of the mass of the neutrinos. So by focusing on this model, I now have a clear picture of how things can work. Sorry? Sorry, which part? Oh, here. Sorry. Absolutely. This is EV. Yeah, EV. Electron volt. EV. Sorry. Yeah. Thanks. So the second point has to do with the H0 compatibility. So in this vertical bands here indicate the one sigma limits of local determinations of the expansion rate today, like using Cepheid variables. And these go through the Galilean constraints, and they do not go through in case of Lambda CM. It's a well-known tension of Lambda CM model that has become more prominent after the release of the Planck data. It is true that there is a lot of ongoing discussion about the role of observational systematics in determining the position of these vertical bands, but taking those aside, taken at face value, this is a tension in Lambda CDM, which is solved when you go to the Galilean model. And then finally, yep.
So you're showing two things in that plot. So the first, you're comparing the blue and the red contours and their disjoints when you don't have neutrinos in that. So the blue solid and dashed are disjoint
yep.
without neutrinos. You add neutrinos, the solid and the dashed have the same central value.
Not the same central value, but they are consistent.
They're consistent. And then separately, you're now showing, your preferred relative to Lambda CDM in the Galileo plus neutrino cosmology, because now you overlap with that second prior NH node.
Yeah. So basically, you cannot forget about the blue. Focus on the red one.
So for H node compatibility, you're forgetting about the blue.
Because the blue is already.
You're forgetting about the green and also ignoring the band.
Why am I forgetting about neutrinos in the green?
For saying why you've got a 6 sigma. Okay.
The 6 sigma preference comes from wanting to shift this constraint of the CMB on the volume of H naught to much smaller ones. So you increase sigma m nu, because if you increase sigma m nu, you can get the same expansion or close to the same expansion history if you decrease H naught.
What would those two sets of contours look like in regular Lambda CDM with no neutrino mass? Would they look more like the red ones? That kind of.
We know, so the Lambda CDM basically doesn't change. So the best fitting point is around here. So, in Lambda CDM, to have or not have massive neutrinos, you have almost the same thing, because in Lambda CDM, the CMB does not provide any evidence for this thing to deviate from zero. If you look at the best fitting point, it's very close to zero, although the contour extends a little bit.
Okay, I think I understand.
Okay, so finally, the last point has to do with the lower clustering amplitude when you add massive neutrinos. So again, okay, I told you to forget about the blue. Let's go back to the blue again. This is an horizontal band, but actually this is fixed at zero. So when you don't have massive neutrinos, this model boosts structure formation. So on large scales, matter is going to cluster. So the amplitude of the matter clustering is going to be, so sigma 8 is of order of 0.95, much larger than in Lambda CDM. But when you add massive neutrinos, although you have an enhanced gravitational force, because now you have a larger fraction of neutrinos, you can lower this value to be compatible with, or to, you can bring the constraint on sigma 8 closer to Lambda CDM. And this shows a very important degeneracy between modifications to gravity and large neutrino fraction, which is the subject of some ongoing research.
And this is the full quintic Galileo marginalized over the Galilean parameters.
Very good question. Yeah. I forgot to mention. Actually, these contours are for the cubic, but they do not change appreciably. If I will show you the quartic and the quintic, you will not see any difference. For these panels here, you get almost the same thing.
Do you have plots with the degeneracy with those additional cubic parameters?
The Galilean ones.
Yeah.
Not on this talk. I can show you later on in the.
Might worry that some of this preference for neutrinos is just driven by marginalizing over some flat direction in those parameters.
No, it's not.
It's not.
No, this preference here is a background preference, and because they all follow the tracker evolution, regardless if they have the cubic, the quartic, or the quintic, they all share the same preference for high values of mass of the.
So it's not driven by those parameters affecting the
no. observations. Because they all follow the background evolution dictated by the tracker condition, and this is this constraint here is mostly determined by modifications to the expansion history, not so much modifications to the way. To the gravitational interaction.
So you said there are only two independent parameters. So, but are you, when you produce this plot, you actually run over all the parameters?
Yes. No, wait. No, I only run over two, and the other two are determined by the one. So I sample over, say, C3 and C4. And C5 and the other parameter is determined by these two. So like it's pretty much like in a flat universe in Lambda CDM, you only sample over the baryon and the Kolar meta density, and the radiation is fixed, and the the dark energy density is a derived parameter. So it's also varying, but it's constrained by your sampling of the baryon and the cold dark matter density.
And the argument of the attractive solution is that even if you sample the whole space, they should give you the same result because the background...
I'm assuming that models reach the tracker sufficiently well before the acceleration starts today. So there's not, it's not like all I can simply assume that. So it's quite, it's actually some constraint that I'm assuming. I'm assuming that the models are reaching the tracker sufficiently well before the universe starts to accelerate.
But when you did show that plot of the tracker earlier, can you just go back to it?
Yep.
So those the red and the green there are only hitting the attractor solution. Yeah, they're hitting it before they drive the accelerated expansion. But they would have different effect on the expansion rate during the radiation era than the blue one, and that would shift the higher acoustic peaks.
It's true that they will, the dark energy dynamics will be completely different, but the dark energy dynamics in the past are subdominant. So you have
sometimes subdominant things like that, like the neutrinos are a subdominant effect like that on the expansion rate during the radiation era, and they also affect the damping. They also affect the silk damping in it.
His red and green curves are down by a factor of 1,000 relative to the dash curve.
Yeah, the green and the red are down by a factor of 1,000.
If
you could still affect some of the higher acoustic peaks.
You do if you keep increasing this too much. You do. For this case, actually, you do not. For this case here. But this is what I mean. You are assuming that the initial density here is sufficiently small.
So the red one, like, would make a difference in the radiation era, but you're restricted to green and below type.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Or somewhere in between the red and the green, something below here. So this is how the best fitting models look like. So this is the CMB temperature power spectrum. So at high L, the models all look the same. The only visible difference is at low L. But so, for instance, the quartic and the cubic can predict a slightly smaller amplitude of the ISW, but I mean, the error bars there are sufficiently large, so stringent constraints cannot be derived from there. The CMB lensing power spectrum looks like this. Again, at high L, at high multiples where the data is, the models are practically indistinguishable. Here, I think it's interesting to note that the models predict very different behavior at low L. So if in the future, so this ascribes to the lensing power spectrum a very strong potential in constraining theories like this. And it's true that to obtain data points on these very large angular scales is quite difficult, but maybe the good news is that the error bar doesn't need to be so precise given the large difference between these models.
Does this include the screening mechanism you're going to use later or no?
No. This so far is linear theory. So when you linearize the equations, you throw away the terms that are going to cause screening. So now I get this question a lot. So why didn't I use, in the constraints, galaxy clustering data? So in principle, so here I'm showing the metapower spectrum for the case of where neutrinos are massive. So enhanced clustering. So in principle, you can, because of the differences here, maybe we can have something to say on the constraints when we try to confront these curves, these linear theory calculations, with the observed LRG. So LRG stands for luminous red galaxies, with the observed galaxy power spectrum. So in principle, yes, we can do that. But there are a number of technical things that we need to take care of first. First of all, we need to understand what is galaxy bias. So galaxies do not trace the dark matter field in the same way as dark matter does. So basically, galaxy bias is going to shift these curves upwards, and we need to model it first. We also need to understand what's the role of redshift space distortions, because when you look at the galaxy, you see the galaxy in redshift space, whereas this calculation is made in configuration space or real space. And then finally, what is the scale? What are the scales k here where I can trust linear theory? So on smaller scales, so large k, you eventually mode coupling will start to become important. This will boost the metapower spectrum on smaller scales. But your naive expectation of where the screening can be important in GR may not be the same in a model that has this nonlinear screening mechanism. So we need to understand these things first, and this can only be properly assessed using n-body simulations. I'm going to do this later on. I'm going to return to this slide towards the end of this. I also get this question a lot. Why didn't I use growth rate data? By modeling redshift space distortions in the galaxy power spectrum, you can come up with these data points for a quantity, which is f sigma 8 as a function of redshift, where f is just a logarithmic derivative of the density field. And Well, first of all, we need to understand if linear theory is indeed valid. So if I can trust these curves to compare with the points. But in the case of a model with such a large fraction of massive neutrinos, I cannot simply use these data points, because the extraction of the points from the data itself assumes that the growth is scale independent. There are ways to try to come up with scale-dependent measurements of this. But for these data points, they assume that growth is scale independent. And this is not something about modified gravity. This is also true for GR. If you have a large fraction of neutrinos, growth will not be scale independent, even in the linear regime. So this essentially prevents us from comparing these points with the data. And I'm illustrating here for two different scales, you see a visible shift in the predictions of the Galilean model, whereas in lambda CM, they stay almost the same because the neutrino fraction is quite small. And in fact, in the past, this data has been used to constrain the Galilean model, and wrong conclusions have been reached because these details have been missed. So now I'm getting to the another main result of this talk, which is which has to do with the integrated Sachs-Wolf effect, the ISW effect. Just to be sure, so this is a secondary anisotropy of the photons of the CMB as they travel from the last scattering until today. When they go through time-varying gravitational potentials, their temperature is going to change. And I'm showing here in this panel the time evolution of the lensing potential for the best-fitting models. So at early times, all models look the same. So we have a constant evolution in the meta era. And then at late times, in lambda CDM, black, potentials go up, so they decay. This means a decay. There's a negative sign here. So the potential decay in lambda CDM, whereas the tendency is for them to become deeper on large scales in the Galilean models. So it is said that the ISW effect is positive in lambda CDM. And because of potential decay, it is said that the ISW effect is negative in the Galilean model. And this constitutes a problem for the observational viability of the model, because there are several lines of evidence that are pointing towards the positiveness of the ISW effect. You can cross-correlate the ISW with galaxies or with the temperature of the CMB. You can, for instance, look at the positions of superclusters and supervoids and see if behind them the CMB looks colder or hotter. And all these experiments point out for a positive ISW effect, which suggests that the Galilean model can be in severe tension here. And actually, this is going to be the main thing why the Galilean model is going to be ruled out. You could have hoped that the screening mechanism could try to modify this prediction here in some way, but the ISW is really sensitive to the largest angular scales, and you do not expect nonlinearities to have a strong effect there. So the situation so far is the following. So with massive neutrinos, the Galilean model can fit the CMB and the BAO with pretty much the same flying colors as lambda CDM. We can still have a look at how the model performs in what concerns galaxy clustering. But this will require modeling nonlinear structure formation. And then this is going to be a main killer, is that the Galilean model predicts a negative ISW effect in contrast at odds with the data. So now we're ready to go nonlinear. So when you want to probe the nonlinear regime of structure formation, ultimately, the most accurate way to do so is via n-body simulations. However, it's helpful to have a look first at the simplest scalar spherical symmetry. So in one dimension, you have an analytic handle of the situation, and this really helps to build some intuition, and which will be helpful to then understand the results of the simulation. So I'm going to work I'm going to perturbate RW in the Newtonian gauge. So recall, so this is only the radial component here. And I'm further assuming the weak field and quasi-static approximations, which are standard in, supposed to be valid in sub-horizon scale. So I neglect the potentials and their first derivatives compared to their second ones. And I also neglect time derivatives of perturbed quantities. So in this setup, the equations look like this. The two Einstein equations and Galilean equation of motion look like this. Chi here is just a scaled radial coordinate. So let me try to guide you through what we have here. So first thing, we identify the normal gravity term. It is there. It's proportional to the density. I'm assuming, again, for simplicity, that my spherical over density is a top hat. So the constant density the density is constant and then goes to zero at the edge. In green, I'm highlighting fifth force terms. So there are terms that add to the normal gravity term and that depend on the spatial gradient of the Galilean field. And then in blue, multiplicative terms that multiply. So all of these coefficients here are time dependent only. And in blue, I have these multiplicative terms that multiply the normal gravity term even when the green terms go to zero. So now the game is the following. For every moment in time and value of the density, I'm going to solve this equation here, which is a six-order algebraic equation. Actually, for the cubic, quartic, and quintic, this equation here is quadratic, cubic, and six-order. It's only six-order in the case of the quintic Euler model. So what I'm going to solve this equation, an algebraic equation, and I'm going to plug the solutions here to determine then the total force that is felt inside of my halo. So I'm showing the result here for the cubic. So I'm defining this quantity here, G effective, which is simply just the ratio of the force in the Galilean model over what you would get in GR. And I'm plotting this as a function of time, so scale factor in the y-axis and density in the x-axis. So at early times, the bottom part of the figure, G effective is equal to 1. So gravity isn't changed. At late times, but in low density regions, gravity is enhanced. Gravity becomes stronger. And in particular, at the present time, gravity can be twice as strong as you would get in GR. And then the interesting part is that at late times, but in high density regions, G effective is again equal to 1. And going from here to here illustrates the implementation of the screening mechanism. So looking at the force equation in the case of the cubic, which is just normal gravity plus the fifth force term. And as the density increases, this term here is going to scale with the square root of the density contrast, as opposed to this one, which scales linearly. So as delta grows, this term becomes effectively suppressed compared to this one. And this is how this model will start looking more and more like GR when you increase the density. More accurately, what is actually happening here is that this model is a model. So every spherical halo has its own size and has of Einstein radius that is determined by the mass of the overdensity. So what's happening is that when you increase the overdensity inside of the halo, the Einstein radius grows, so that if you are still inside of the halo, you are more and more inside of the Einstein radius, and the fifth force is more and more suppressed. So compared to other screening mechanisms that are out there, for instance, the chameleon mechanism, which is the one that is implemented in F of R, in the chameleon case, the screening depends on the environment. So the sun will be screened in different ways if it will be sitting in the middle of the void or in the Milky Way, what it is. In this case, the screening is different. The screening depends only on the properties of the source and not on the environment where the source is. So this is the same plot for the quartic. We have almost the same thing as in the cubic with one very important difference. And with this, I get to another main result of this, which is that at late times in high density regions, you do not recover general relativity. So looking at the force equation in the quartic model, so when the spatial, even when the spatial gradient of the Galilean field go to zero because of the screening mechanism, and they do, you still have the multiplicative term, which is time dependent and cannot be affected by the nonlinearity of the screening. And this term here is what is causing the weakening of gravity in high density regions. And this term here, the origin of this term can be traced back to the explicit couplings that are needed in the fourth Lagrangian to keep the theory ghost-free in a curved spacetime. So this can pose, this poses a very important observational tension in this model, because in the solar system, which lives here, so it's at late times in high densities, gravity is not only different, G effective is not only different from one, neither it is constant. So here I'm showing the Markov chains used in the constraints of the quartic model. Colored, so C4 is in here. This is the best fitting point. And these are colored by the rate of change of G effective and the value of G effective. And the lunar laser ranging experiments constrain the rate of change of G effective to lie within this bound. So when I apply this bound there, I see that the only regions that satisfy this are those where C4 is sufficiently close to zero. So this is basically, these solar system tests are basically making the quartic sector of the Galilean model collapse into the cubic sector. And as a matter of fact, this is also something that could have happened in the quintic model, because of the in the quintic model, instead of a coupling to R, you have a coupling to the Einstein tensor. The case of the quintic model is even funnier, because I cannot simply compute the predictions in high density regions. Let me try to explain. So this is the Galilean field equation of motion, six order in the case of the quintic. So mathematically speaking, you have six solutions. So I'm showing here for redshift 0, so scale factor 1, I'm showing here the density dependence of five of these six branches. The sixth one is just up the scale, but that's not really important. The physical branch is the one that satisfies this. So basically, it's the one that recovers the linear theory expectation that when the density contrast goes to zero, so when everything becomes homogeneous, you should not get a fifth force. So if you follow, as the density increases, if you follow the physical branch, you see that it eventually disappears, merges with this branch. And by disappear here, I mean it becomes a complex root of this algebraic equation. So this basically, this simply prevents me from computing the predictions of the quintic model for high-density regions. So what can we take from this? Well,
doesn't that just tell you you should go on to the other branch at that point?
Which one? This one?
Yeah.
Both become complex.
Well, is it actually singular there, or is it just complex? Because if it's just complex, it suggests that you're not parameterizing it with the right field. In the same way that the DBI action.
So just like you're trying to go to say that this would be simply a breakdown of the model. The model does not admit these solutions.
Yeah, maybe a coordinate singularity in field space rather than a singularity that's not doing anything crazy.
I haven't thought about that. The first thing I thought was because I'm assuming some approximations, so the weak field and quasi-static approximations. First thing I thought is that maybe those missing terms, when added to the equation, would help fix this. But I can argue that these terms here I indeed expect to be small, so this equation should not change too much even when you include these terms. Now my second conclusion is, does this simply mean that for the best fitting parameters of the CMB that you simply cannot find a real solution for the fifth force on the, or for the gradient, for the configuration of the Galilean field in a spherical setup? I can leave this as an open question. We can discuss this further, but this is a bit odd. But I mean, bottom line, the main thing is that this simply prevents me, at least with the setup that I've introduced, prevents me from further studying the quintic model in the nonlinear regime. Now I get to the part of the n-body simulation. So to explain how the n-body simulations work and just the algorithm, that will be a talk on its own. I'm going to skip that. I'm going to limit myself to show you the results. So we have used just the Cosmos code, which is a modified version of another code called Ramses. We have used, like, this is the setup, this number of particles in a cosmological, in a box 200 megaparsecs per side, and we start the simulation at redshift 49. So in the next few slides, this is going to be the color scheme. I'm going to show you the results for the cubic and for the quartic. I'm going to show the results for three variants of the model. In blue is what I call the full model, basically the Galilean expansion history, and GR plus the screened fifth force. In green, I call this model the linear model, which is the model where I artificially suppress the screening mechanism. So I'm looking at nonlinear structure formation, but with a linearized G effective. So comparing the blue with the green will allow us to measure the effectiveness of the screening in suppressing the modifications to gravity. And then finally, in red, a model I call QCDM, which shares the same expansion history, but where gravity behaves as in GR, so we can use this model to compare these two against it. So okay, so the first result is the halo mass function result. So the halo mass function is just a number density of dark matter halos as a function of their mass. I'm showing here, so the data points, the points here are the simulation results. You can ignore the lines for now. And I'm showing here the relative difference of each of the variants with respect to the QCDM model. So in the case of the cubic, you see that when gravity is not screened, so structure formation is very efficient, and you end up with a lot more massive halos than you will have in GR. When you turn the screening on, when you go from the green to the blue, you still have an enhancement in the number of halos, but which is considerably smaller than in the linearized case. So this shows that the screening mechanism is really efficient in the case of the cubic model. In the case of the quartic, the linear model behaves in a similar way because gravity is enhanced. But because of the weakening of gravity, because of the failure of the screening mechanism in suppressing all of the modifications, so gravity becomes weaker, and so you end up with fewer halos than you would get in general relativity. You can also have a look at halo concentrations. Then the conclusion qualitatively is the same. The screening is very efficient in the cubic model. So the halo concentration, so the inner structure of the halos barely changes when you go from GR to a screened fifth force. And in the quartic Galilean, because of the weakening of gravity, you get much shallower halos. Metapower spectrum, same qualitative conclusion. But here, there's another piece of important information, which is that so the dashed lines here show the linear theory calculation, the points, the simulations, and you see that the two agree on scales k smaller than 0.1h over megaparsec. So now I have determined the scales k here where I know I can trust linear theory. So now I can go back to my galaxy power spectrum plot, and I know what are the regions, what is the range of k with which I can compare my curves with the data points. The last result is the result for halo bias. So a halo is a very nonlinear structure, so it doesn't trace the linear density field exactly. So the halo bias is just the definition, just this thing here. You look for the correlations in the halos, and then you divide by the correlations in the linear density field. So basically, it's a measure of how halos cluster relative to the underlying dark matter field. And it's a growing function of the mass. And the point here, the point I want to make, is that in the cubic LLM, compared to lambda CDM in dashed, halo bias is smaller. In the quartic, because of the weakening of gravity, halo bias becomes slightly larger. So now, as promised, going back to this plot. So now I think I have everything I need to make a more robust comparison between these lines and the data points in here. So I want to relate these two things. And I do this via this equation. The linear power spectrum is related by the LRG power spectrum in redshift space by a constant term here, which accounts for galaxy bias. So it's a parameter that needs to be determined. So this thing just shifts these curves up and down. And then a redshift space distortions term, which is known as the Kaiser effect, which depends also on the galaxy bias and on the linear growth factor. So now I know from the two slides ago that I can trust linear theory on these very large scales. So I can measure this ratio here. I can compute f because it's linear theory, and I can solve for the galaxy bias, and I get that it's 1.6 for both the cubic and quartic, and slightly larger in the case of lambda CDM. These galaxies, in addition to its power spectrum, they're also characterized by the number density, which has this number here. And the question now I want to ask is it possible for me to go to the dark matter halos of my simulations, put galaxies in them in such a way to reproduce the inferred galaxy bias, and the observed number density. So this is.
So in the case of the quartic LLM, you're getting less clustering in general, even than in GR, which sounds like you've got a fit force that's repulsive almost, which sounds like a ghost. Are you? Is that kind of stable?
Why does it sound like a ghost?
If you have a ghost scalar field, it creates a repulsive fit force rather than an attractive one, which it sounds.
Maybe this will help you. This will answer your question. If you look at the force equation, the scalar field is not doing anything. The weakening of gravity is caused by this coupling here. So you're picking up the background part of these terms here, multiplying by gravity. So this is like a scalar tensor theory. So the scalar field is actually not responsible for the weakening of gravity. The clustering of the Galilean field actually in the quartic model, this starts to scale, starts to be constant as you increase the density. It's not small phi that's causing the weakening of gravity. It's this explicit coupling of the background field to.
The weakening of G2.
Yeah, exactly. So I was saying that I need to find a realistic way of populating halos with galaxies. So I'm going to postulate a functional form for something that's called the halo occupation distribution model, so a Hoth model, so which is nothing but the mean number densities of galaxies as a function of their mass. And this is specified by a minimum mass above which halos start to get a galaxy, and simply a width for the transition between no galaxies to one galaxy. And I'm assuming, because these are luminous red galaxies, they are quite big, I'm assuming that each halo is going to have only one galaxy. So satellite galaxies inside halos is quite rare, so I can assume that. The galaxy number density and halo bias are just computed as weighted averages of the simulation results of the halo bias in the simulations and the halo of the halo abundances and the halo bias in the simulations weighted by the Hoth. And then I'm going to vary these two parameters to try to minimize this chi-square quantity. And I'm assuming like these errors here are given by this, although this is not, so this is an assumption of mine, which is not crucial for the conclusions. So this is what I get. So I get here the confidence contours on the parameters of my Hoth model. So the dashed and the dot correspond respectively to each of these individual bits of the chi-square, and the fact that they overlap means that the model can indeed reproduce at the same time the inferred galaxy bias and the inferred number and the observed number density. So if these two contours will not overlap, then this will be a tension. So it's fine for here. And this is the best fitting Hall model. So almost no galaxies on halos of this mass, one galaxy on sufficiently massive halos. And they look very similar to Lambda CDM, and they are realistic. So by realistic, I mean if these curves would extend to sufficiently smaller masses. So these luminous red galaxies are quite big objects. Their stellar mass is thought to be about 10 to the 11 solar masses. And you don't expect to see a galaxy habiting a dark matter halo that is comparable in size. So you want the galaxy to have it to be a small thing inside of a much bigger dark matter halo. So the Halls are realistic. And also interesting to note that they are very similar to Lambda CDM. So although you have very different growth of structure on nonlinear and on linear scales, your degeneracies with halo number densities and halo biases kind of conspire in such a way that you can just to fit the same data, you can just distribute galaxies in pretty much the same way as in Lambda CDM. And this really highlights the importance of looking into. So this conclusion would be impossible if I had not done the n-body simulations, because I would not have a handle on the number densities and on the halo bias. So I reach the end of the Galilean part of the talk. So just to recap, CMB and BAO are well fitted in the CMB, provided they have sufficiently massive neutrinos. Galaxy halo distributions are not a problem in this model. I mean, because you can explore the degeneracy between enhanced linear growth, halo number densities, and galaxy bias. And then the explicit couplings to curvature are leading to observational tensions because of time variations of the solar system. So this basically makes the entire Galilean theory collapse at its cubic sector. However, the cubic sector is the one for which the ISW is the most negative. So it's the one that is most severe tension with the observational data. So I don't want to use strong words saying that the model is ruled out. So I just basically say that it's at least hard to reconcile this theory with these observations. How much time do I get?
Well, there's a little bit of a delay, maybe another 5.
Okay, so I'm just 5 minutes into the non-local model. So this is the action. Again, the same picture, GR plus matter plus some term that causes the acceleration. To solve this model, is useful to introduce two scalar quantities, U and S, defined in this way, box minus 1 of R, box minus 1 of U. The meaning of box minus 1 is just an integral with the aid of the Green function. This is why the model is called non-local, an integral. It's a non-local operation. And a non-local model, in addition to being specified by its action or by its equation of motions, you also need to specify an homogeneous solution and the Green function. The homogeneous solution, actually, I take it to be 0 in accordance with what Maggiore and Macarella did in the original paper. And you need to impose by hand that your Green function is the retarded version, not the advanced one. And this needs to be done by hand. This does not occur naturally from here. And you need to do this to ensure causality. And then using these two definitions here, you can cast this non-local version of the action, which will make you to solve integral equations. You can instead cast them in a localized version of which looks like a scalar tensor theory, where these two guys here are just like random multipliers that impose these two constraints here.
I'm sorry, what is the motivation for doing this, proposing this action?
This action here in specific, box minus 2 of R.
Yeah, but what is the physical motivation?
It works. It gives you acceleration. So you're saying why is it not box minus 1? Is that it? Yeah, I think they tried box minus 1 and probably didn't get acceleration, and box minus 2, they end up. So everything in this field is pretty phenomenological. You go around and try and find something that reproduces the acceleration, and then probably it's your guy's job to try to explain why this makes sense. If I follow the same thing, now I can go quickly on this. These are the equations relevant for structure formation. The two potentials are the same. This is the modified Poisson equation. This is sort of like a G effective, which grows with time. Can be up to 6%, gravity can be up to 6% stronger than in GR at the present time. Remember, in the case of the cubic model, this was much larger, so gravity could be almost 100% stronger. But the problem here is that this is time dependent only. There is no scale dependence, there is no apparent screening mechanism. So it seems that this model doesn't lie doesn't satisfy those two first basic requisites that I first mentioned. It's because, so this model, for fixed cosmological parameters, this model tells you that this is the rate of change, whereas it's much larger than what observations allowed. So the solar system is likely to have a say in ruling out this model in the same way as it rules out the quartic Kellner model, for instance. I mean, this didn't stop me from looking at other predictions. So here, I'm showing the expansion rate, the fractional difference with respect to lambda CDM in this model. So expansion rate is smaller. So I also expect, if this model was healthy in terms of massive neutrinos, that this model is going to have a slight preference for massive neutrinos because H is intrinsically smaller. So, and this can be compensated by increasing the sum of the mass of neutrinos. I looked also at the CMB. Looks very similar. N-body simulations show that the power spectrum only increases by about 10 to 15% on all scales. So this is quite small given the current data, but the future may pinpoint some of these differences. So really, just to finish off, I hope that I managed to show you that when it comes to constrained modified gravity models, it is very important that first you determine if the model fits sufficiently well what I call here the holy grail of cosmological data, which is the CMB and BAO, and also supernova. And when you do this, it's very important that you forget about almost everything you know about lambda CDM. So for instance, have you assumed that this value here is close to zero, which is what you typically have in lambda CDM, you would be ruling out the Kellner model prematurely. And in fact, wrong conclusions about the viability of the model have been drawn precisely by missing things like this. So once the model fits this, then you can go and have a look and focus on smaller scales, do more targeted tests of the theory, and you can have a look at galaxy distributions, both like power spectrum, velocities, ISW, growth rate, solar system, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So just to end up with a closing statement, like people today are designing future cosmological surveys with, they are aiming at statistical errors that are going to be very, very tiny, for theory bias to become more and more of a concern. So if in the future we want this data to be able to actually test alternative theories of gravity rather than just serving as mere consistency tests of GR or of lambda CDM, then we need to abandon a lot of lambda CDM assumptions that are made in the process of extracting the data itself. So although I focused on the Galilean model or the non-local model, I think that in-depth studies of alternative models, either on a model-by-model basis or in some general parameterization, are going to be needed for us to have a look, to know exactly how gravity can impact the observables, for us to know exactly what are the assumptions that we can trust and design better our future observational surveys. And stop here. Thank you.
So, in future, if there's some Earth-based detection of the overall scale of the neutrino masses, would you say you can use that just like the solar system tests on the, I think it was the quintic model. So in one of your models, you had this central value of C3 or whatever it was, and the solar system tests require you to be way out in the tails of the distribution. Mm-hmm. So you infer that model is ruled out by solar system tests combined with cosmology. Would you say the same is true of neutrino masses if on Earth we go away and we measure the neutrino mass to be 0.2 eV, or the sum of the neutrino mass to be 0.2, you've got the same situation?
Yes.
That's like a really, you know, awesome falsifiable statement that you can make, you know.
No, I mean, you would say,
if they go out and measure neutrinos and it's not what you need there,
if you find that the mass of neutrinos is 0.2, then this will signify attention for this model. Because for this model to fit the CMB, this model needs the mass of neutrinos to be at least 0.4. Yeah. So if you find it's 0.2, then that's it. This model is in trouble. In the same way, if you find that the mass of neutrinos is 0.6 eV, then maybe lambda CDM is in trouble.
In the spherical part of the talk, what happens if the density is negative, like you're in a void that's mildly nonlinear? Because it's hard in practice to find. You have the other version of this for the cubic one. You know, it's hard to find systems that live in that upper red region because most of the collapsed things already have an overdensity of 200, right? They already have delta 200. But if you went into the voids, you could maybe find underdense things that had deltas of order of, you know, minus one-ish, and maybe you might see something there.
It's interesting you point that out. If I can I draw? So the same figure, but in voids, will look like this. So now this is minus one, this is zero. This is scale factor, one, two, zero to one. So now this will be like the continuation of this figure into negative values of density. You see that gravity, it keeps its value there, so transition to this side. Basically, this is just this part. Transition from here to here is continuous.
Okay.
So you also find that here, G effective is equal to 1, G effective is equal to G. And you kind of find like something like this. And then gravity here is enhanced. And what I'm showing here, this bit here is funny, because for sufficiently negative values, I find again negative roots for the fifth force. I cannot evaluate the fifth force in very, very low density regions. But this one I can explain why. This is probably due to the quantistatic approximation. The quantistatic approximation is not supposed to hold inside very low density regions, because here the gravitational potentials are very weak as opposed to in halos. So the fact that I find here that the force becomes complex is probably because this approximation here becomes less and less valid, or relaxing this approximation will lead to more and more important terms in here. But I think maybe relaxing this will probably lead to enhanced gravity inside of the voids as well, inspired by the fact that the transition remains from here is continuous.
Any other questions?
Just one on the overall philosophy of the slide. I mean, you might say Kilde Ockham's Razor says everything that's ever been proposed as alternative to MCG is vastly more complicated. So until I have positive evidence, unless it's just I can generate papers.
But how do you get
with the tools you've got? He's got. You can compare those in a completely Bayesian way. You can just compute the Bayesian evidence comparing one to CDM and this theory. You integrate over the initial parameters, and you can do it in a completely Bayesian way. But I would think that you can answer that question by computing the Bayesian evidence.
I don't see alternative. How do you test? How do you know you're not? You say wait until there's something that doesn't fit. Yeah, but you have to have something.
Exactly. I was going to do that.
No,
I was going.
No, until there's evidence that the MCN is failing in some way.
But how do you, exactly, how do you look for that evidence?
Yeah.
It's by looking at modifications to gravity that you know where. For instance, let me give an example. Something, an observable that is very, very sensitive to modifications to gravity are galaxy velocities. So the galaxy, so velocities are first affected, and because gravity boosts the velocities, only later on the density field is modified. So the velocity field is very, very sensitive to modifications to gravity. How did we find out about this? By running n-body simulations and modified gravity models. It was not like, okay, you could have guessed, okay, maybe velocities are going to be more affected than the density field. But actually, people ran n-body simulations and modified gravity models, and they found, wait a minute, the velocities look a lot different. So now there are ongoing projects to focus galaxy surveys on getting more and more robust velocity measurements, because this can provide a targeting test for modifications to gravity. So it was by making a paper that people realize, hold on, velocities can have something to say here. So this is kind of like my philosophy. It's worth studying this because it helps us understand what types of signatures can we find out there. Because if we are too focused on the CDM, we're going to end up being biased to it, and it is harder and harder to find deviations on departures. Not to mention the fact that a lot of the surveys so far assume lambda CDM. The Poisson equation is assumed in many, many steps of the data reduction. So your data can only be used to test the consistency of the data, not so much test alternative models. I don't know if my philosophy answer.
Maybe I could just add two things. A pro-Kurt point is that you certainly can find that the lambda CDM doesn't fit the data without having an alternative model, just by finding that the reduced chi-squared becomes terrible or something like that. But on the other hand, I mean, the reason for other things is that most people don't find lambda CDM very satisfying.
I'm just saying, you know, as a relative statement, okay. I mean, satisfying, well, I don't know. Compared to, with respect.
No, it's not my model.
Really?
I didn't invent this.
It's a straw man, right? You need a straw man to pet it a lot of times. You don't have to believe the theory, but if you construct a straw man, it helps you think of new avenues to go for. Right? You might not have thought to put a lot of money into a velocity survey, but if you find out, right, like you said, a velocity survey can prove things you didn't know, then you go and put a bunch of money into a velocity survey.
Yeah, I mean, example, lensing.
Just
to complete the velocity, another example, mass estimates. Different modifiers, gravity model modified, lensing mass modify the tool potentials in different ways. So this means that when you estimate a mass of a cluster using dynamical methods by looking at its X-ray emission and by looking at its lensing, if you find a difference there, this can be a signature of modified gravity. So this is by studying modified gravity models, we realize, wait a minute, the two potentials are different. So mass estimates will differ here. So can this be a proof of modified gravity? So just to give another example, so there are ongoing projects of trying to get better ways of estimating these masses in two different ways, which are sensitive to two different potentials. And if there's modified gravity, then you might see a signal in there. Sorry, I interrupted.
I was just going to make a sociological comment. I think everybody in this room agrees that, you know, finding a deviation would be interesting. But it's not necessarily true in the wider astronomy community. So if you go through another 10 years of finding everything agrees with lambda CDM, there's going to be a large portion of people who are going to say, let's put our money in finding planets. Cosmology's finished. So in that sense, your point is valid. So hopefully something will
happen. And I think
something
there are other things that, you know, strong theoretic problems, which, okay, they didn't even think we needed to do something different.
You hear that argument a lot. What do we need to measure? W is minus one, plus or minus some tiny error bar. Isn't it finished? That argument comes up quite a bit. So it's something to be aware of.
And there's some danger about, you know, let your observations be guided by you trying to get towards your favorite theories, you know, as opposed to just, you know, let them see what's there independent of what the theorists would like to be true.
But I mean, the way Daddy said it is a realistic thing. I mean, you have to decide what experiments.
Yeah, and I think the Dark Energy Task Force parameterized that by just to say, let's assume that there's a W, right? And that's what guided the thinking, you know, up until, you know, maybe 5 years or so, and now people are starting to think about the fluctuations as well as just sort of, you know, possible stuff, which is what's relevant here.
And even then, you need a theoretical prior to decide, well, you know, what figure of merit is good. You know, how far do you need to measure the minus ones? How many significant figures until you really know something? You need a straw man that gives you a theoretical prior that says, this is an interesting scale to aim for.
Okay, well, let's continue this discussion. And thank you, Peter.